It was intended for the human to support the machine to support the human at work.
And AI means something different to anybody you talk to, which is wild.
This is AI or Die.
Welcome back to AI or Die. Quick weather report in Columbus. It's hot. It's oppressively hot, like high 90s. I know, B, you don't want to talk about weather, but this is notable. This is the die portion of AI or Die. Like, we're cooking out here, man.
You broke the rule just to kick us off.
This opening with the weather. Yeah, apologize to the listeners at home, no matter what time of year it is. At the date of recording, it is oppressively hot here in Columbus, man. It really is.
And humid.
And humid. So it's a don't go outside kind of a day, or if you do, go to the pool or something like that. It's not only the longest day of the summer, but it feels like it's going to be the hottest day of the summer too. Brendan, Reagan, good to see you guys. How are you? Brendan, where are you at? How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm in Barcelona. I was in Madrid this morning and I went to Ibiza last week. So got to go down to the Mediterranean, check out the islands, do the boating, swimming, beaches, all that wonderful stuff. So I'm back and ready to go.
Yeah, man, you're looking like you got some color. You're looking good. Looking good. What's up, Reagan? How you been? What's new with you?
Not a ton. Just getting back into the swing of things. Took a long weekend, a little bit of R&R, but yeah, back and ready to go. Excited. Fixed. I found a fix for so I don't look like an alien.
Yeah, we'll give you less green now.
I have a green screen that I got a while ago, and I just like, it's one of the foldable ones, and I just unfolded it and put it up against my window. So seems to be working.
So you're essentially in like a windowless room now? Because that was a big pro of working in there. It's like, yeah, this cool window and you can see the outdoors and stuff.
Yeah, it's only while I'm recording, just so I don't look crazy. Although a little bit of green tint just came in. Sorry for the people that aren't watching the video. It's a fun, you know, process.
For the folks who are watching the video, let's start a tally. Let's start a count of how often she turns green throughout and see if we can tally it up by the end of the year. Well, very exciting times at Align AI. We have a ton of folks, obviously, on our platform, which is very exciting, too. Lots of news happening. I know we just did a weather pause, but I want to get into the news corner of today's episode. There's some really interesting stuff happening. I know there was something that really Colorado recently released as finally like the first kind of in the nation law for AI in their state, related to protecting the individual consumer. Essentially, we'll share the link to the bill. It's not going to go into effect until 2026, but essentially it's designed to help protect folks if you're impacted by, think about if you're fired or hired and using some sort of AI algorithm to assess your performance based on the job. The company essentially has to disclose that an AI algorithm was used, and there's measures to basically go through and understand the bias and potential discrimination built into that algorithm if it's impacting decisions like hiring or firing, or even insurance rates and how those sorts of decisions are decided too. So I was reading through the bill this morning and it really centers around hiring and firing decisions and really insurance rates and kind of helping to protect the individual consumer by first forcing companies to disclose that they're using some sort of AI in the decision-making process. And if the consumer feels like it was wrongfully done, basically requirements of the company to provide information around how the it was trained and the bias that could potentially be built into there too. Very cool, kind of first state in the nation to do it. Wanted to get your guys' reflection on that. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, they keep mentioning high risk in there. So I think they're trying to be all encompassing on like a general risk profile of some of these systems. A lot of what I've seen is just kind of like human rights based topics. So housing is included in that. Insurance is included. You mentioned employment being included in that. I don't think that this is new per se. There's some stuff in New York that also addresses this. For example, there's like local law, I think it's 114 or something like that. And it doesn't call, I don't think it calls out AI specifically, but it talks about autonomous systems that make hiring decisions and requiring a third party auditor to actually evaluate the system that's being used. And of course, automated systems can leverage AI. So they're looking for things like bias and discrimination. I think the Colorado bill is trying to give people a way to report or escalate if they feel like they're being treated unfairly, which you should do with or without AI. Let's be real. You know, if you feel like you're wrongly fired by a person or an AI system, there should be a process for you to escalate that. I think the difference is how that gets investigated and remediated, right? And that's where we should be looking at processes to support stuff like that. So I think I saw some pretty mixed signals when this was being originally circulated around people getting frustrated that people, that Colorado specifically, is trying to put more restrictions in place. However, I think it's not uncommon for people to be talking about this high-risk profile use cases. This is exactly what the AI, you know, EU Act is addressing as well. So not surprising to me at all.
Kind of cool, though, that it gives a mechanism for an individual, maybe a more formal process for them to get help if they do feel like they were wrongfully, you know, fired. Brendan, what, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I just think it's interesting that Colorado is passing this after doing the Data Privacy Act that they passed, not recently, but it's been in effect for a while. So I'm really curious to see how it happens between like the state level and the federal level, because I know Colorado had implemented some app out kind of language and ability. I used to live in Colorado too, so I was like, leverage that as like a citizen in Colorado. And it's similar to what some of the mechanisms that are available inside of GDPR. So I'm curious to see like if Colorado is going to be leading a lot more of this, if it's going to start happening more at the federal level rather than just the state level like this. So it'd be interesting to see how that kind of plays out and what Colorado's role is around that going forward.
Yeah, I agree. And if other states will follow suit too. Again, hearing about New York at some point last year, now Colorado, is going to be similar. And I wonder, you know, what states are going to step up, if it's going to be more West Coast focused, if it's going to orient towards the coasts, or if other states like Illinois are going to pop up with a lot of the work that's going on in Chicago too. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, really the big differences are just the requirements that they're putting in place around disclosures, I think, is one of the major takeaways I had from that bill. For example, I think it had mentioned that you're legally obligated to report if there was bias detected in the last like 30 or 90 days. Same thing with like kind of the breach requirements that you have as a company. And if there is a breach, a data breach that happens, you are required in a lot of cases to report that to customers within a certain time period. You know, so I think they're trying to put more protections around consumers, which is generally a good thing. I just wonder how some of that stuff is going to get enforced.
Especially on the company side, if each state has different requirements around what they ask of you, is it dependent on where the company's headquartered, what state that is in, where the user is impacted? I could totally see just like a web of all the different state requirements that we have to keep tabs on, essentially, and set up controls for. For sure. Interesting stuff. In other news, it looks like one of the co-founders of OpenAI, Ilya Sutskever, let me know if I butchered that name, essentially is starting their own SSI Inc. Superintelligence, or Safe Superintelligence Incorporated. And they made an announcement yesterday that it's officially a thing in there, starting to really focus on building safe superintelligence, building in responsibility and capabilities in line with each other. And of course, projecting out, if you want to work for us, come and join us in that way too. Interesting that he's taking that lane though of safe superintelligence and really projecting it out in that way. Kind of interesting also, concurrently, Apple is talking about their own Apple Intelligence and a real focus on privacy and hosting models on devices to help protect the end user's privacy, given that such a significant concern. Overall, the governance and the privacy is really shaping up to be something that really is discussed alongside the capabilities too. I'm not sure if you guys read more about SSI Inc. or Safe Superintelligence Inc., but that is pretty interesting. Reagan, do you have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, for sure. So I think this idea, it's one, it's interesting they put Safe Superintelligence as the name. I think he wanted to be extremely explicit that that is what they were aiming towards. Two, I think it's interesting he's using superintelligence instead of AGI. Because the definitions of these systems are actually getting quite interesting. I listened to Roman Yampolsky on Lex Friedman's podcast. It's actually a very, very good episode if anybody is interested in the AI safety side of things. Now, he might be kind of on an extreme end of it, but it's always good to get those different types of perspective. But I think he had one of the best definitions for these different types of intelligence that I've at least come across. He's talking about general intelligence, meaning that a system can be, you know, up to speed on particular tasks that humans can do. So think about a person and the general intelligence that an individual has. And when you think about super intelligence, you're looking at, like, imagine you like took all of the people's skills in the entire world and made one person that could do all of those skills. So you're an expert in all things and not just an expert in one thing or a few things. And so when we're talking about super intelligence, you know, that tends to be the general definition that people are talking about, is that you've got one system that will supersede any individual's capability of intelligence. So I just think it's interesting that he moved in that direction. I am not, again, not surprised, because he was one of the people that was very, very vocal about wanting to maintain a really strong kind of safety or, you know, responsible team for AI at OpenAI. And he was very vocal about that. And it was quite interesting in some of the articles that I read about him talking about this, is that it's not a trust and safety team. They're not thinking about it in that capacity. They're not trying to just throw guardrails on top of a system. They're trying to have technological breakthroughs that actually prevent these systems from deviating from the intention and doing something harmful. So instead of it having the capability to do harm and putting guardrails and slaps on the wrist against that, he's trying to fundamentally bake that into the system. He did claim that he is not going to be building products or doing anything commercially until they actually get to the point where they have safe super intelligence, and that will be their first product, so they won't be distracted. And so, yeah, it was really, really fascinating just to see how he was talking about it. Not shocked at all that he's doing it, not shocked at all that he started something like this, but just the way that he's talking about it, I think is interesting.
Yeah, Brendan, your thoughts?
Yeah, it's really cool to see how quickly it's moving from what we'd initially been doing with AI even into superintelligence, and like the fact that safety piece is foundational to it. Similar to how Anthropic started with that, similar to compete with OpenAI, having that in their foundation. I'll be curious to see like if the market wants the solutions that provide things like superintelligence to have that baked in fundamentally as well. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
For sure. I actually want to point to that too. I was on a podcast earlier today, and we were talking about what is keeping these companies from actually adopting AI. And I said, one is just like figuring out what the game-changing use cases are for that company, which is pretty unique and special to them. And two was this risk management element, which is basically putting the onus on the company to think about risk and put those risk guardrails in place. And that is what's happening today. And that is what's so frustrating for a lot of companies, is that there's so much that can go wrong, and you're basically handing them, you know, a really makeshift vehicle and telling them to like figure out where it's going to crash and where it's going to, you know, break down. And they don't feel that they know it well enough to be able to put those types of things in place, or at least some companies. So I think baking it into the system or providing more tools for companies so that they don't have to start from scratch there, I think is going to be actually revolutionary in terms of adoption.
I agree. And it seems like today a lot of more of the traditional enterprises are really focusing on internal facing kind of solutions and use cases related to that, because they're still figuring out how do we get those gated access controls in place? How do we manage that risk? Even some of the really, really huge enterprises are building their own internal chat agent in that way, trying to set up its own general intelligence across a lot of the existing docs, especially in terms of onboarding new employees and fielding a lot of the questions that they could ask too. Very interesting stuff. Let's see if superintelligence, as opposed to AGI, starts to become more and more of the vocabulary related to this too. It's interesting. I know we touched on Apple already. They had a WWDC event where they finally upgraded Siri. I think it's been like 15 years or something like that since Siri's come out, but huge updates with their partnership with OpenAI. One thing that really struck me, very similar to Microsoft's approach with their devices, is keeping the model on the device as much as possible, and then giving users the option to, if what they're requesting takes more computing power than what the device can offer, then connecting it to the cloud and essentially data centers in that way. But like letting users essentially make that decision, do I want to keep it on the device, or do I want to leverage the cloud or my own personal cloud with Apple to basically continue to ask questions and ask the more complex questions too. Very, very interesting stuff. Obviously a big privacy take. And I think it was funny because if you remember Google's and all the other companies' announcements related to this, they said AI hundreds of times. So it's kind of a meme related to the announcements. But with this, they termed Apple Intelligence, I think only said AI a handful of times too. So different approaches, different ways to skin a cat, but all of them starting to put these stuff on the hardware and keeping it on-prem as much as possible, it seems like.
Yep, they're really, I think they're sticking to their slogan on, you know, think different, right? So they're trying to come up with a new, more novel, at least marketing angle to this. I think it's interesting. I think they're thinking about it from a usability perspective. They're definitely thinking about it from a privacy perspective. They're pretty forward thinking about data privacy, and they know their consumer base really well and that they care about that. And so I think they're going to build in that direction. And I'm not surprised that they're one of the last ones to make announcements on it, just trying to be more thoughtful about it, which I personally think is the right move. Like, what does it matter if you make an announcement a few months later, maybe besides a jump in stock price or something, you know, but long term, if you're able to bring products to market that people actually find useful, I think wait a little bit and then release. I really personally don't see the benefit in doing it preemptively just to jump on the hype train. You know, I think we're kind of exhausted of that by now anyway. So, you know, you're definitely not going to be the first to do it at this point, and might as well take your time and be a little bit more thoughtful, which I think they were. I do love this idea of people being able to automate a lot of tasks without having to open apps, for example, and using AI to do that and making it a lot more seamless. I think that's the future of mobile devices. It'll move away from this really rigid app login situation and more towards this fluid workflow of things that we're trying to accomplish while weaving together apps that are already on the phone and using AI to do that. So yeah, really fascinating. I'm not an Apple user, so I can't speak to excitement about Siri and whatever else. So
yeah, I'm curious what the relationship will be between, like, what do you do in the iOS, like Apple's Siri and that versus like the ChatGPT application, because I use that a lot on my phone actually instead of Google search now. So I'm kind of curious to see how that develops. I did notice the other day, and I don't think I've opted in for anything yet, but I did notice that it like detected I had a flight and then asked me to turn on airplane mode. So I've seen a couple of those little kind of like hotkey automation things that they've been kind of helping you set up and recommending for you. So I'm curious if they'll kind of take that further. I just hope that it becomes very useful, very time-saving things, because that would really help. The other thing I'll say as an Apple user is, like, if it can really integrate into the Google stuff, that'd be great, because a lot of the calendar, Gmail, Maps, all those things, still don't want to have to use Apple's products for that. So hopefully they find a good way to have Siri provide a cohesive experience using AI across non-native Apple applications as well.
If it ultimately leads to less screen time, I'm all for it. Again, make it so I have to spend less time hunting and finding the app, the information within each too. So I hope that's a positive kind of outcome of this. As an also Apple user, I'm annoyed because I just upgraded to an iPhone 15, and this is only available on the 15 Pro. So if I want this, now I got to get the top of the line iPhone that's available, of course, right? It's Apple. They're going to build in all the pricing tiers and all that too. So
yeah, I think what I would be interested in is seeing what that performance lift for Siri is. I got to tell you, the voice interactivity of ChatGPT 4.0 is really great. I actually find it to be a very pleasant experience, and I've been using it a lot more now. Not just, I was using text pretty heavy, started getting into images and using text and images now, and now getting into voice and really leveraging that. I personally think it's been a pretty good experience. And in fact, I was at New York for New York Tech Week, and I went to an OpenAI event. There were probably, I don't know, about 100 people there, but they had a couple of their engineers demoing some of the newer capabilities, and the inflection points of the voice are a little bit better. So it feels like more of a natural conversation. And then the second piece that I thought was really great was the interruption piece. So actually being able to interrupt it and say, no, 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 more like this. And it actually reacting very quickly to that instead of having to wait until it's done. I find that to be a more of a natural progression with the voice. So I wonder how much that's going to influence new releases of Siri as well. I personally think it's pretty game changing.
I agree that interaction model is going to totally change. Kind of related, actually. We're talking about ChatGPT and its embedding within Apple products and things like that too. I was just reading that basically News Corp, the parent company to the Wall Street Journal, run by the Murdoch family, just struck a deal with ChatGPT and OpenAI to basically display their news content within ChatGPT now, with links to the articles related to that too. With this being obviously an election year in America, I think it's very interesting timing, but also it seems like a lot of these news organizations shifting to understanding that the user interaction with the internet is going to shift to be more with these chat interfaces within ChatGPT and other ones too, and making it so they can directly link their content to it instead of depending on ChatGPT to basically pick and choose what news sources it pulls information from and summarizes it for users too. But very interesting. I'm kind of concerned just in terms of the different news corporations setting up deals with, again, the single engagement point for a lot of people going into the internet like this. I want to get your guys' thoughts on it.
Yeah, I think I actually like the trend of them licensing content. I think it'll be so interesting to see how many of these companies become content companies that start to work behind the scenes and start to actually just get most of their revenue through these licensing deals. Because, you know, like you mentioned, maybe some of the individual subscription models are going away. And you start to unify a lot of that information. And I don't know what this looks like yet, but a really seamless way of verifying the information would be a nice step too in the interface. I know Perplexity does a pretty good job of that by linking the reference points so you can go right to it. And so I still think that there's like a fact-checking reference link, you know, web traffic moving out like we talked about in the last month's episode. But I actually kind of like this trend of the companies paying organizations like that who have the content, are curating the content, are finding the content. Because that part's still hard. The journalists are still going out, interviewing, fact-checking, writing, and curating things. And that part's not going away. And so I think, honestly, it begs the question on whether or not, like, how vetted do you have to be? Do we trust a media organization to vet those types of journalists, to get those types of people to create that type of content? It's less about branding now. It's more about vetting and truth finding. And can they start to, you know, contract some of that out to people who might not be under that organization, but are also kind of a reputable source of content generation and journalism, which I just think is really fascinating. I make this point a lot too for enterprises. Also, you can't just slap a chatbot on top of all of your docs inside of your company. Half of those documents are out of date, inaccurate, not correct, conflicting. And so, you know, we're running into that same problem with the internet data. And so how do we find more of these curated, trusted sources that we can fact check against? So I actually really like the general direction this is going in.
It's interesting too, because when you look at a chatbot compared to like a web page, right? Like we always had Google for the discoverability layer, and then you had a web page that would basically curate the content. And that seems to be very compressed now in the chat interface world with an LLM behind it. So to your point, like that content, that company doesn't need to spend time like the New York Times with like the way they've done their web pages, the way they've created those web and experiences and interactions. They can focus more just purely on the content side, because a lot of that is handled through the LLM interface, because I do think it's like compressing what we used to do with Google plus a web page and making it one kind of seamless experience, which is great. So I think it will definitely impact what that looks like from the user's perspective.
What I'm curious about is, because I'm not sure if you guys seen that map of all the different news sources, there's inherent bias with a majority of the news sources of being inherently leaning liberal versus conservative. I wonder if you'll be able to tell ChatGPT, give me the conservative take or the more liberal take, and ultimately getting to the different kind of perspectives on the same truth. And just drawing parallels to that with what folks are seeing within the enterprise, even in terms of we're seeing the source of truth of what a process should be done or what a specific decision should be made and the logic behind it. We do find variation across the users and the folks who are recommending the standard process that folks follow. So getting ultimately to the source of truth, quote unquote, that everyone tries to go for, but balancing, everyone's got a different opinion on really the best way to do a thing. And what is the one thing ultimately we want an agent to recommend to this company or a mass amount of individuals who are prompting against it?
I would love to have a personalized model that started to learn my preferences. And also, like, I know we're so used to chatting at these things, like telling it what you want. But I think changing that paradigm to say, like, imagine you asked about a news source and it said back to you, like, are you interested in seeing both sides of this particular topic? Are you interested in seeing blah, 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 blah? Like, and learning that over time, or at least providing questions back to you potentially. I'd love to see more of that user experience where it's kind of interactive and there's, you know, it's thought provoking. It's not just waiting for you to tell it what to do. It actually provides a little bit of interactivity and maybe thought exercise back to you to get you thinking more. And I think that would be a really fascinating shift as well.
Inherently less of a blank slate. And again, back to these companies, when you're prompting it around what's the best way to develop a visual, giving that same conversation, are you interested in seeing how marketing has done this? Are you interested in seeing how the collections team has done a similar visual in this way too? Just to help you understand there are different ways to do it. There's no one right way, and just giving you that perspective so you can get some inspiration from it instead of just, again, making it feel very one way, to your point, Reagan. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting hearing, like, I think I heard this on All In, but I can't remember. There was a source I pulled this from, but they were basically saying, I want, you know, a high level executive type of persona. I don't want to be talking at an intern that can go fetch information without thought behind it. I want somebody who has thought behind it. Like when you hire a really good executive or a really good leader or somebody who's really strategic, and you ask them for something, they typically ask you really thoughtful questions back to clarify, you know, what do you mean by that? Or, hey, there's like three different versions of this. You know, the marketing one might be interesting because of this, or the sales one might be interesting because of that. You know, there's a bunch of different dynamics that I think you can start to incorporate. And I would love to see a shift more in that direction.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's where it's on the onus right now is on the user to kind of put that into the prompt. And I wonder if that will change because there's such a large variation in users' knowledge of prompting, because you do have to provide so much context to the model. I wonder if the models will get more intelligent about saying, hey, based on what you're saying there, let me try to refine what your intention is so that I understand it and that I can give you the best information back.
For sure, which I think people would be fine with, you know, making it more conversational that way. Good point.
Nice segue.
We're very excited to have a good friend of mine and also somebody who works with us a lot here at Align AI, Shari Beth. Shari is focused very much on visual design, beautiful graphics, as well as user interaction, and is getting a master's right now specifically focused around design for AI. So very cutting edge work. She shows me her coursework and it's amazing because it's not only the design best practices, but they're also learning how to code, how to prompt, how to directly interface with these models. So I think it's such a good perspective to bring not only that design side, but also that deep understanding of the AI side. So very excited to have you on the podcast and welcome aboard.
Thank you. I'm very, very excited to be here. And like, this is my first time participating in a podcast.
Happy to be your first one, Shari Beth. So with that, could you please give folks just a background of kind of your focus area in design? And obviously, you're a friend of the show. We've worked with you for a few years now at this point. So just for the listeners in, who is Shari Beth and what sort of work that you do, especially related to AI, just to give folks an intro to some of your background?
Yeah, well, I'm a UX designer and I've been working with the company for a couple of years now. And well, I'm focused on making all of the experiences for the users and also for the users to make the most of the tools. And now that, as Brendan was mentioning, that I'm doing this master's in AI and having an understanding of how also the back end of these products works, it's very helpful for me as a designer to understand what are the things that users are not able to see, like on an interface. So to take that into account and try to put all of the features to be handy to users in the interface and that they can make the most of AI, because I believe that we could do so much more with it. And right now, the design is not up to the level of the technology.
Totally agree. That's something we talk about a lot as more, especially employees in large companies, are engaging with AI models as products that live within their teams. A lot of times, UX and really design of the interface is kind of an afterthought because the internal data scientists are so focused on building ultimately the logic and training it as well too. So I think especially the UX and the design side of these AI solutions is a growing space and a a big reason why we wanted to have you on. I also understand you recently you attended the AI for Good conference as well too. That's something I definitely want to talk to you about on this episode, because I'm sure there's a ton of really big insights from that.
Yeah, it was very interesting to attend to one of those type of events. And also, I believe that I was like living in a bubble, and my everyday life is just about engineering and design, and not only at work, but also in school. So hearing perspectives from other sectors, it was also a lot about like what AI is doing for the health industry, or there were people from the government of many countries around the world. And so it was really interesting to hear what other people is doing outside the technology world. And I believe that the design aspect of it is a very, very new thing. So yeah, it was super insightful.
Yeah, what's your perspective on, especially after attending that AI for Good conference, but also the work that you do with companies like us, what's your perspective on the approach for design in AI systems? I know there's a lot of thought around the conversational aspect of tools like ChatGPT, but from your perspective, what do you think is the best practices that a lot of companies and large enterprises should think about, especially as they're deploying their own internal solutions with an AI aspect to it that folks are engaging with?
That's a hard question, because I believe that what what companies are doing nowadays with AI is like a tiny, tiny piece of what it's done and about to be in the future. But I also have like this romantic way of seeing things because I'm a designer. But I do believe at the same time that companies are using AI to leverage their revenue or the reach that they have, like with an audience, and having this powerful tool to make things better and efficient, could be used at the same time to say like, okay, we are solving this problem, or we have this value proposition in our company, but what could we add to that? I believe that now companies will have room to add another goal.
What do you think are some of the design aspects that are underconsidered or not considered enough when folks who maybe don't have as deep of a background in design as you have are putting a solution out there? This can be AI solution specific or just overall when we're talking about design for a large amount of employees in an enterprise. What are some of the aspects that are underthought of that you'd recommend folks spend more time on?
Well, I believe that we get to live inside a bubble, and sometimes we forget that probably not all users have the same skills or will think the same way about things. So like I was saying at the beginning, there are so many things that could be done with AI, and like people don't even know how to do the basic yet because they haven't been exposed to that. So I believe that as a designer, we have that responsibility of like educate people on how to use it or how to accomplish tasks with the least amount of pain points, or to make it more intuitive and seamless experiences. And now with AI, you can have like 10 times the actions to be made in a page, or so you have to really be good at prioritizing, or it's something that we always do from the beginning to step in the user shoes. But now I believe that we need to do that even more and to really think in the way that users will think, and to understand that there are so many different types of users and they will see and use and think about the AI in a different way. So now we have to consider so many more things than we used to.
Yeah, it's interesting because like as we've worked on projects together, where my head usually goes is from a design perspective, you're really trying to clearly understand the user, their goals. And then the unique thing about generative AI is that it is so open-ended because you can have a conversation, it can go many different ways. Like you mentioned, you have to design for those hundreds of possibilities, not just the 3 to 5 jobs to be done we're thinking about. So I think it's interesting when we are starting to design these experiences, because we're actually trying to like limit what the model can do instead of trying to maximize the total number of interactions that a user can have. Really want to figure out how to use the technology to simplify it, either through the user interface or through the backend prompting and how the model's working, to really restrict that. So I think that's such an interesting aspect of this design, is really constraining down what the user can do and simplifying it, given how many different routes are available to them. So just curious what you've seen, or any interesting kind of like projects that you've seen around how to limit or really constrain the user's experience when working with something generative or conversational.
Yeah, that's a good point, and something that I always talk about. We are moving towards that in so many tools. For example, if we talk about Midjourney, and we see how they have been evolving to have these sliders to control the output and to adjust all of the parameters instead of having users to write it down in a prompt. So I believe that it's also about making it the most intuitive way for users and preventing them from having a hard time trying to describe or having to think about numbers or to think about percentages. I believe that we can make it so easy for people to do whatever tasks they have to do.
That's great. Yeah, and actually it makes me think of another question, because we work with a lot of enterprises, and I've yet to see a designer on an AI project inside of an enterprise, which I think is a very lacking kind of voice at the table in those conversations. So I think a lot of people in our audience will probably be on projects without a designer available. So from your kind of perspective, what advice would you give a more, you know, main things to focus on to really represent that voice of the user, the design process, design thinking, when there's really not a designer at the table? It's the engineers, the business, but not really that design kind of creative bridge. So any advice or like kind of major points that you think would help them if they lack a designer on a project?
To hire a designer.
It's always a good first thing to do.
Yeah, I believe that it's very hard for someone that hasn't been trained as a designer or a creative. I mean, like, everybody could have a creative way of solving problems, but I do believe that you need some sort of training to achieve that. So, I mean, companies that are not able to do that at the moment could probably train their employees to have a more user-centric way of solving problems, or to ask themselves questions about the user and to think about the user a little bit more, even though they're engineers, developers, or in general, not only the users.
I think that would help a lot with some of the ethical challenges that people are facing too, is kind of putting more of that empathetic element into the process. I know we often complain a lot about how organizations and teams don't have those skill sets, especially we tend to find, you know, data scientists are very curious, but they sometimes struggle to think through the actual process that the person is going through when they're building a system. And they're looking at it from a feasibility perspective and not necessarily from what needs to happen. And that gets really challenging. It was, as you were speaking earlier, I was thinking a lot about what is a good parallel to this. You know, if you're selling a whiteboard, how do you sell like the possibilities of things you can do on the whiteboard, right? I feel like we're there with generative AI. It's just, if you were to sell specific types of creative tools instead of just this blank slate. And that's what people are calling these point solutions in the industry, is just stuff that solves very specific problems so that we can constrain the problem set and the users to be more specific. And we can think very deeply about that instead of this super, super open-ended mechanism for people to just kind of do whatever. So yeah, it's really interesting that you're mentioning adding some of those design elements into the process. I think it's important for everyone to have that empathy for the user when they're building these systems and actually talk to them. Are there certain tactics or approaches that you use when you're trying to, you know, get into the mindset of the end user, especially when it comes to AI?
I always try to think the way many users will do. I always say that to friends. I try to think that my grandpa or my grandma is going to use the tool. So I try to make it as easy, straightforward possible for them. Nowadays, we have so much noise from everywhere. So right now, that cliche of less is more. So I also try to keep things very simple. And part of my process is always looking at other tools, no matter if they are non-related to what I'm about to design or what I'm about to do. But you can also find inspiration. I mean, if you're working, let's say, in a generative AI product, you could find design patterns or ideas, like this app for recording the podcast. At the core, I believe that all products share so many things, and like sometimes we overlook those.
I remember putting together, because we did a UX design for data practitioners session with a large enterprise last year, Sherry Beth. And I remember an aspect of that being, and when I was working with you on that, the aspect really being thinking about the personas, as you mentioned before, but tactically, essentially doing a whiteboarding session of, okay, if we're creating this for a marketing leader, listing out what do they struggle with today? What are direct quotes we've heard from them? What does their workflow look like when they'd want to leverage something like this? I think we can say generally, we want to understand the end user, but really going and writing down and showing it back to that end user of, here's our perception of your workflow, the trigger in your work that would lead to you going to this AI solution or this BI solution that we're putting out there for you. And ultimately, providing context next to that solution of, this was designed for marketing strategists and it's intended for them to understand answers to this question, this question, and this question. Having the good design, but also being very clear around its intention for folks, because people are very busy, and giving them those clear instructions around the intention of it, I think also helps to reduce the confusion and ultimately drive adoption of a solution at the end of the day too. Is there anything, because I know we're coming up on time, is there anything else from, because I think the fact that you were able to attend that AI for Good event, is there anything else that jumped out to you as overall themes that folks were discussing or aha moments that you had from attending that event that you'd want to share with our audience?
We are living in a very tiny bubble, and like bigger things are being done right now. It caught my attention. This co-founder of Humane gave a talk about research that he's doing to understand how other species communicate so that we could improve the way humans communicate to gather insights from the way that they interact or like the sounds they make and the rhythm. And that was very interesting. I believe that now we have a little bit of room to explore other things, because I believe that for so many things we can rely a little bit on AI and we can save time. I believe that we are sometimes very in front of the computer and get to see what things are being done. There were so many devices, gadgets, or like there was this exoskeleton to help people to walk, and they were using AI. It was very interesting to see the things that are happening that are not inside a computer.
Yeah. And really, as a designer, as a creative, what's your perspective around how this popularity of AI and all the AI solutions coming to market are influencing your work? So how are you personally feeling the impact, or how do you foresee, especially the UX design capability, getting influenced by a lot of the AI solutions that are coming to market?
Well, I do believe that if you don't start using them, you totally get behind things. Not that your work is going to become less important, but actually the opposite, because that makes you a more skilled professional. Like that's the way I see it. If you know how to structure a prompt, or that also teaches you how to communicate better. in your workplace, or to even structure your ideas and thoughts better so you could design better. I do believe that it somehow trains you to become more efficient in everything you do, and not only the times that you're using an assistant, but somehow you adopt that habit of optimizing your time in everything you do and to jump into solutions quicker.
Yeah. Very consistent with how we're hearing company leaders especially talk about this as well. There's a competitive aspect, but there's also the efficiency, the operational aspect, especially this year, around how to think about our work differently and all the different solutions we could plug in relatively easily or easier than ever before to supplement our work and just make us faster at getting things done too.
Yeah, Sherry Beth, you reminded me of my father-in-law was saying that you should get married when you've had to deal with dial-up internet, like when you've seen your partner have to deal with, you know, internet that's not working, and just see their level of patience. And I think about that as the early stages of some of these generative AI tools, and like, it does not get what you want right away. If you don't prompt it correctly, you've got to be really patient and thorough and think about, how do I reword this and how do I make it more explicit? And so you're right. I think it does teach people better, more thoughtful communication skills. It forces you to put more effort into your communication, at least where it's at today. So I thought that was a really fun point.
How would you like folks to reach out? LinkedIn? Is there anything else that you have out there that you want to recommend folks check out in your space?
Yeah, probably LinkedIn, because I don't believe that anybody wants to see my Twitter or X account. I only tweet memes. So yeah, I'll share my LinkedIn. It's like my name is Charibeth Lopez, but I can send it over to you.
Yeah, that's great. And just want to thank you again for your time today, Sherry Beth. Appreciate you coming on this episode and giving a designer's perspective, because I think we talk on other episodes about how AI is impacting creatives and how creatives are leveraging it in their work too. Just hearing it firsthand from you, I think, was super helpful for our audience as well. So thank you for your time today. I appreciate you hopping on our episode 15.
No, thank you for being my first podcast episode.
We are honored. All right, everybody. Well, this was AI or Die episode 15. Thanks for listening. We will see you on the next one. Take care, everybody.